Something or some things have changed in our education system that require us to play catch-up now. In order to discern what those changes have been and what, if anything, can be done to correct them, we must first take a look at the history of education in North America. From there, we can determine how our education system has not only changed itself, but also how it's caused substantial changes in all of our enterprises of government, business, and community life. Then perhaps we will be challenged to make some new changes that will better fit our needs today. The very first American education law was written by the Puritans of the Massachusetts Bay Colony in 1647. The Old Deluder Act required that any community, upon reaching a population of 50 families, hire a teacher. When the community grew to 100 households, they were then to build a school building. The Puritans understood the need for literacy, particularly to enable all citizens to be able to read the scriptures for themselves, in order to withstand the devil, or that old deluder, Satan. The Old Deluder Act of 1647 predated the founding of America as a nation by more than 100 years, so it was not obviously an example of national government involvement in education. It was a local community effort that arose from the needs of local families, and it was focused only on teaching children to read, the most basic educational skill. Few of America's founding fathers received much of their education in an organized school setting. While some attended private schools, most were schooled at home by their parents or private tutors, or they were self-taught. Ben Franklin, for example, started school at the age of 8, then came home when he was 10 to assist in his father's business, and he learned mostly from his father, who, by the way, had very little or no formal schooling. Washington attended school for only 2 years, then taught himself. Jefferson studied with a private tutor. This was the early American pattern. Yet, as John Adams remarked in 1765, a native of America who cannot read or write is as rare an appearance as a comet or an earthquake. Schooling continued to be available for all who wanted it and pursued it. An 1830 article in the Philadelphia National Gazette said, "Education in general must be the work of the intelligence, need, and enterprise of individuals and associations. At present, in nearly all of the most populous parts of the United States, it is attainable for nearly all the inhabitants." Some New England schools were tax-supported under state law, but they had to compete with academically superior private academies. Education across most of the country, however, was completely laissez-faire. School attendance was voluntary, and schools were funded either privately or by charity. And what were the results of America's early education efforts prior to the rise of an organized school system? Well, according to the census of 1840, fully 90% of white adults were listed as literate. In 1860, that number had risen to 94%. By way of comparison, a 1993 U.S. Department of Education study showed that only 50% of American adults were moderately literate. In the early 1800s, changes in Europe led to state control of education there. Educational elites and intellectual leaders in America, particularly the Harvard Unitarians and followers of Robert Owen, were attracted to the idea, believing that placing all children in a centrally controlled institutional environment under the direction of the state would lead to a perfect society. It was the beginnings of socialism, even before the term was invented. These early American socialists were attracted to what was happening to education in Germany. The Prussian public school system had everything that they wanted: full state funding by involuntary taxation, teachers trained by the state, a standard state-prescribed curriculum, age-segregated classrooms with military-like discipline, compulsory attendance laws enforced by truant officers, and effective ways to keep independent-minded parents in check. Promoted first in liberal churches in New England, universal public education following the Prussian model soon became viewed as the best way to preserve America's Protestant majority from a flood of Catholic immigrants. Protestant denominations joined together on the basis of what they shared in common, hence the term common schools. But many did not realize that much of what they agreed to had a very different purpose, one that they would only begin to understand over a century later. And interestingly, after the American Civil War, Northern bankers and industrialists brought the Prussian model of schooling to the defeated South. Horace Mann, known as the father of American public education, oddly enough did not start out with any particular interest in education. His teaching experience was limited to 2 years as a tutor at Brown University just after his graduation from there. He went on to become a lawyer, then to serve in the Massachusetts state legislature. After his election in 1836, Massachusetts Governor Edward Everett set out to remake his state's education system after the Prussian model. As president of the Senate, Horace Mann led the passage of a new law that Everett wanted to allow him to appoint a state school board, effectively taking control of local schools out of the hands of local officials and placing it in the hands of the state. Everett then appointed Mann as the secretary of the new Massachusetts State School Board. Mann took on his new job with the zeal of a missionary, and he regarded the transformation of education into a state-controlled, tax-supported bureaucracy as a mission. Supported by wealthy, influential friends, Mann focused with the zeal of a martyr on the task of perfecting the human race and creating heaven on earth through universal state-run education. Abraham Lincoln had said, "The philosophy of the classroom in this generation will be the philosophy of politics, government, and life in the next." To determine the philosophy that would reign in the classroom, social planners and other supporters of state-run education had to determine who would be the teachers in the classroom and what the teachers would believe. To accomplish that, Mann concentrated on establishing teacher colleges, known as normal schools. James G. Carter, in an 1825 pamphlet, called the first normal school at Lexington, Massachusetts, quote, "an engine to sway the public sentiment, the public morals, and the public religion more powerful than any other in the possession of the government," unquote. And it became a model that was visited, studied, and duplicated nationwide, though it contributed immediately to a reduced literacy by promoting the whole word method of teaching reading. Mann also set out to convince the middle and professional class to withdraw their children from private schools and to place them in the new common schools for the good of the entire society. He appealed to their religious sentiment first by pointing out that the common schools had first been set up for religious purposes, but he misrepresented what that purpose was, which was to teach children to read the scriptures, not that they might perfect other children by forced association. Nevertheless, many parents bought the statist argument that their duty to their community was more important than their duty to their children, and the purpose of public schools as instruments of social change first and academics second was quickly established. Though parents may not have known it, they were fulfilling the wildest dreams of Karl Marx and Frederick Engels, who wrote in the Communist Manifesto in 1848 that they wanted to stop the exploitation of children by their parents by destroying the most hallowed of relations when we replace home education by social. They wrote that the hallowed correlation of parents and child between the family and education was disgusting bourgeois claptrap. The next big player who was instrumental in applying this socialist statist education system to America was John Dewey, who furthered the demise of the neighborhood school and promoted the takeover of education by big industry and government via psychologically experimental methods. Dewey, like Mann, clearly understood the religious element that is inherent within education. "Our schools," he said, "are performing an infinitely religious work. They are promoting social unity. Religion associated with dogmatic beliefs we see disappearing. It is the part of man to work for the transformation of all practical instrumentalities of education till they are in harmony with these ideas." Underscoring the importance of Mann's earlier initiative to have the state teach the teachers, Dewey described teachers in almost messiah-like terms. "Every teacher should realize he is a social servant set apart for the maintenance of the proper social order and the securing of the right social growth. In this way, the teacher is always the prophet of the true God and the usherer in of the true kingdom of heaven." After taking over the teacher colleges, the next thing that these education statists had to do was to take charge of the textbooks that our children learn from. Gary North points out that what the textbook contains is not so important as what it leaves out. It leaves out evidence of rival views. The war for the minds of the next generation has been more carefully laid out by textbook committees than by any consortium or conspiratorial meeting behind closed doors. The textbook committees control by elimination. George Orwell wrote in his eerily accurate book, 1984, "Whoever controls the image and information of the past determines what and how future generations will think. Whoever controls the information and images of the present determines how these same people will view the past. Lester Frank Ward, the father of American Central Planning, who called education a systematic process for the manufacture of correct opinions, laid down the design template for school textbooks using this exclusion method. Our minds, he said, resist coercion to change our deep-seated opinions. But if educators, particularly those who wrote the textbooks that all schools would use, would eliminate any mention of competing ideas, nothing would be left in our minds but those opinions that the educators want us to have. And what ideas did those educators want us to have? Why, that there's nothing more important for us to learn while we are young than that which is necessary for us to go out, get a good job, and become productive members of society. Elsewhere in this course, you learn about a group of politicians, bankers, and businessmen who met in secret in 1913 on Jekyll Island, and how that meeting quite radically changed life in America. At around the same time as that fateful visit to Jekyll Island, many of these same players who gave us the Federal Reserve System were involved in other business ventures besides banking. They realized that they needed a cooperative, submissive, and well-trained workforce in order to accomplish their goals. Schools, then, were to play a vital role in producing these workers. In 1917, another meeting took place involving many of the same players, names like Rockefeller and Carnegie, that just as radically changed life and lifelong opinions in America by altering the direction of government-controlled schooling. This group, the Education Trust, included not only big players from the world of finance and big business, but also from the world of education. Names like Harvard and Stanford and the National Education Association. And their purpose, according to British evolutionist Benjamin Kidd, was to impose on the young the ideal of subordination. As former New York State Teacher of the Year John Taylor Gatto described it, students were to learn to think of themselves as employees competing for the favor of management, not as Franklin or Edison had once regarded themselves as self-determined free agents. No longer were rugged individualism and Yankee entrepreneurialism to be regarded as the strength and pride of America. Instead, young people were taught that their strength was to be found in submission to the greater good of the group, or as a backwards look at history shows, to the manpower needs of industrialists who had invested huge amounts of capital in new machinery that required factory workers to operate. And a new term was born, human resources. Frederick Gates, who John D. Rockefeller hired to oversee the spending of his vast riches, wrote in his book, The Country School of Tomorrow, "In our dream, we have limitless resources, and the people yield themselves with perfect docility to our molding hand. The present educational functions fade from our minds, and unhampered by tradition, we work our own goodwill upon a grateful and responsive rural folk." But none of those limitless resources were to be spent on a challenging academic education for these country folk. No, Gates said, "We shall not search for great artists, musicians, doctors, statesmen, of whom we have ample supply. The task is very simple. We will organize children and teach them to do in a perfect way the things their fathers and mothers are doing in an imperfect way." That organizational plan was to separate the people into at least two distinct classes, and education was the tool that was to be used to do it. Consider this statement that was made by President Woodrow Wilson in a speech to businessmen just prior to World War I. "We want one class to have a liberal education. We want another class, a very much larger class of necessity, to forgo the privilege of a liberal education and fit themselves to perform specific, difficult, manual tasks." In 1922, New York Mayor John Hillen described the Rockefeller Foundation that had seized the schools as, quote, "an invisible government," unquote.